Well, not very long. We got in a little bit late, but had a wonderful day today and appreciate the good hospitality that I've been shown since I've been here. We're studying about a very important subject, I believe, because the Bible says a lot about the future and wants us to have a good perception of what's coming. And I believe there are those who have other ideas about it than you'll hear about tonight. Maybe some of you here do not hold the same view about some of these things that I do. Since I'm up here, I get to talk more than you do. But we want to study these together. And there are those who put out their views into public and in books and radio and television, and so we will be examining some of those to see how they measure up with Scripture as we understand it, and then would hope that you would study those and see which you believe is, which views would be the best to hold. So we're passing out a sheet right now, which is a copy of a chart that we studied last night some, and we'll study that some more tonight. And this chart sets before us the view held by many, sometimes called the premillennial view, that is the view that Jesus will return before the millennium, 1,000 years. And we want to set that view before you a little bit tonight, review what we said last night about it. Forrest, we need another one down here. So we want to set that view before us briefly tonight, and then we're going to begin to take each stage of that and discuss it in the rest of our sessions. That will be the approach we're taking here tonight. I think it's important for us to understand what other people believe, and I have studied their books carefully to condense their views into this chart. So let's take a look at this chart first tonight, and then we will discuss various items about it. So let me direct you first to this side of the chart over here where it says Christ comes to earth. Christ comes to earth. This view holds that when Jesus came the first time, he came to do two things primarily. He came to die for the sins of the world, and he came to establish a kingdom, an earthly kingdom, a kingdom that would be a restoration of the kingdom of David and Solomon, a kingdom that would reign over territory and peoples and have taxes and soldiers and that kind of kingdom, that's the kind of kingdom he came to establish. And so let's talk about that piece just a moment. Was that Jesus' purpose to come and establish that kind of kingdom? Write on your copy, if you have something to write with, John 6:15. John 6:15. Write it right over here by this part over here. John 6:15. John 6:15 says that the people were going to take Jesus by force and make him king. What kind of king did they want him to be? Well, they wanted him to be a physical king, to rule over, to throw off the Romans and be their king over the nation of Israel. And so if Jesus came to do that, here is his opportunity. Here is a great chance. Now, this theory says that Jesus didn't do that because the Jews turned him down, but here they are asking him to be that kind of king. And who turns who down? He turns them down from being that kind of king. That's not the kind of king Jesus came to be a king over territory and to reign as an earthly king. In fact, that's what he said. Here's another verse to write down beside that, which is John 18:36, where Jesus told Pilate, Pilate said, "Are you a king?" And Jesus said, "Yes, I'm a king." Say it with me. But my kingdom is not of this world. So Jesus did not come to be that kind of king. So on this first point, I believe the Bible teaches that Jesus did not come to be an earthly physical king, to have that kind of kingdom. God had that kind of kingdom in the Old Testament, but when Jesus came, he was going to establish something different, something new, a spiritual kingdom. Now let's move on to the next piece of this chart. Right here says signs, Matthew 24. This view says that Jesus gave signs by which his followers could tell when the end of the world was approaching. We know those signs like wars and rumors of wars and earthquakes and famines. These are signs which, these are words that appear in that set of verses. Matthew 24, 4 through 14. And so there are some who say those, Jesus gave those as signs by which to tell when the end of the world is coming. Now that's our main thrust of our lesson tonight, is to study Matthew 24 verses, we'll study the whole chapter of Matthew 24 and 25. So I'm going to pass that one right now and we'll come back to that and see if that was what Jesus taught in Matthew 24. But let's go ahead and lay the rest of this before you just a moment to get it in people's minds. The next thing is rapture, the rapture. Those who hold this view say that when Jesus, that there'll come a time when Jesus will raise the Christian dead before he raises other dead. He'll raise the Christian dead and take all the living Christians. And the Christian dead and the living Christians will go with him up into heaven. And they'll be with him in heaven for a period of 7 years. So that Jesus is going to, this is called the rapture. And at that time, the Christian dead will be raised, the Christian living will be changed, and they'll go to heaven to be with the Lord. And then at that time will arise two antichrists, and they will plunge the world into World War III. And there'll be a period of tribulation from here to here, during which time the Jewish temple will be rebuilt, and there'll be war over Israel. And then in the midst of that great war over Israel, Jesus will return. That war over Israel will climax in what's called the Battle of Armageddon, they say. And then Jesus returns, puts down the fighting, and then establishes the kingdom here that he meant to establish over here but failed to do. And then he'll reign for 1,000 years on earth right here with those who have been raptured that come back to that, to be in that kingdom, with the Old Testament good dead that'll be raised into that kingdom. And with those who have been converted during this 7 year period, they'll go into that kingdom in their mortal bodies. And so there'll be this 1,000 year reign on earth to be followed by another resurrection of the bad dead and another judgment, the great white throne judgment of Revelation chapter 20. And then the righteous will go into heaven and the wicked into hell for eternity. Now that's the general picture of that theory. So tonight we're talking about the signs. Tomorrow night we'll talk about the tribulation aspects, particularly the rapture and the antichrist. We'll talk about tomorrow night. And then on Sunday morning we'll talk about the Battle of Armageddon. And Sunday at church we'll talk about the 1,000 year reign. So that's kind of how this is going to lay out for our studies. Now let's go to Matthew chapter 24. And 25 and study that for tonight. And so if you have your Bibles, you can open them to Matthew chapter 24. And we will begin our study of that passage of Scripture. Now, we want to divide this study tonight into 10 parts. 10 parts we'll have tonight. And the first of those, we're going to call the occasion, the occasion. What caused Jesus to begin this teaching? What caused him to get on this subject? Well, in Matthew 23, Jesus is delivering those woes unto the scribes and Pharisees. He says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, you tithe mint, anise, and cumin, and you leave undone the weightier matters of the law. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, because you whiten the tombs of the prophets and say, if we lived when they did, we wouldn't have treated the prophets like they did. When the truth is, you're about to become the worst of the prophet killers. Though not his exact words, but they're going to be the greatest of prophet killers. Why? Who are they about to kill? Him. So they're going to be the greatest of the prophet killers. And he says, therefore, something really bad is going to happen to you. And so upon you, he says, may come all the righteous blood. The punishment for prophet killing has been saved up. And you're about to be the worst of the prophet killers. And therefore, this great punishment being saved up is about to be poured out on you. Now, in chapter 24, verse 36, he says a very interesting thing. He says, all these things will come upon this generation. This generation. That's very important, because who did he mean when he said these things will come upon this generation? Well, who was about to kill him? That generation, those people then alive. Those people who were alive at that time, he refers to as this generation. All these things, this punishment for prophet killing is going to be poured out upon this generation. Hold that in your mind. We'll come back to that in a minute. Now, Jesus then is very moved by this event. And he says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often would I have gathered you under my wings like a hen gathers the chicks, and you would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. Their house. What was the house of the Jews? The temple. I saw our lips move, the reason I pointed at her, okay. The temple. Their temple, their city, their house is going to be left desolate. This is all going to be destroyed. Now, he was standing up on the temple courts when he said all this. Your house is left unto you desolate. Now, at this point, the apostles, we're now into the first of Matthew 24, they seem to point at the buildings around and say, look at all of this. Isn't this wonderful? And it was. The Jewish temple was one of the great buildings of the ancient world. It was not quite on a par with the Parthenon, but it was a beautiful, magnificent structure. And they, as if in their minds, they say, surely you don't mean this. Look at all this. And Jesus says, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Behold, he says, there will not be one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. That temple building was built out of huge, massive stones that had been quarried there in Jerusalem, were beautifully done, and he says there won't be one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. That's how completely this is all going to be destroyed. Well, that kind of shakes the apostles when they hear that, but they go on down now out the Golden Gate on the east side of the temple courts, down through the Kidron Valley, and up on the hill on the other side. And there they can look back down on this, on the Mount of Olives, they can look back down. In about 4 weeks from now, I'll be standing in that spot. I'm leading a group to the Holy Land, and we leave the 17th of June. So we'll be standing on that spot, and we'll look back on that temple ground. Now, there are two Muslim mosques there right now, so you have to use your imagination a little bit to get the temple there. But they looked down on that spot and could see it, and they came to him, and they had questions for him. So here comes part two, the question. Matthew records the question like this. When shall these things be, and what shall be the sign by which we'll know the end is coming? What shall be the sign of your coming and the end of the world or the end of the age? Now, the question is worded a little differently in the account that Mark and Luke give of this same event. So let's get those three accounts together, and that'll help us to see what question they asked. According to Mark 13:4 and Luke 21:7, he said, they said, when shall these things be? The when question. And what shall be the sign when these things are about to come to pass? So as Matthew records it, when and what will be the sign of the end of the age? To them, it was the end of the age when this temple was going to be destroyed. So I don't think their question really was, when is the end of the world? But when is this going to happen, this destruction you're talking about? And what will be the sign that will tell us it's about to happen? When and what sign? So that's the question that the apostles ask. When and what signs? Now let's take a brief time out and look over at verse 34. Because this verse helps us to put a marker in our study. In verse 34, Jesus, by the time he reaches that point, he says that these things, this generation shall not pass away till all these things are accomplished. That is, everything before verse 34 is going to happen to this generation. Well, who is this generation? Well, he told us back in chapter 23, didn't he? When he said, all these things, this destruction is going to come on this generation. So, everything before verse 34 then is about this destruction of Jerusalem Jesus is talking about, the destruction of the temple that he's talking about. Everything before verse 34 is about that event. This generation, the ones he's talking to, will not pass away until all these things have been accomplished. Now let's go back and look at our next section, which is the possibly misleading events. Number three, the possibly misleading events. Now, Jesus starts this section by saying, do not be deceived. Do not be fooled. That is, in Jesus' mind, now there's some things that you might make a mistake about. I want to be sure you don't make a mistake about this. Don't be fooled when these things happen. Don't be fooled by what? By wars and rumors of wars and earthquakes and famines. Now, Jesus said these words in 30 AD. The destruction of the temple was not going to happen until when? 70 AD. So it's 40 years. Now, here are these people who have understood that the temple is going to be destroyed. But it's not going to happen for 40 years. So Jesus says, now look, during that 40-year period, you're going to hear about wars and rumors of wars and earthquakes and famines and persecutions and all these things. Don't be fooled by those into thinking they will tell you when the temple is going to be destroyed. Don't be fooled by those things. He does not say to them, when these things happen, you'll know it's about to be destroyed. He says, don't use these as signs. Do not be fooled. Don't be fooled when you hear of wars and rumors of wars and earthquakes and famines. Don't be fooled by those things. And so it is interesting that people have taken the non-signs that Jesus gave and made signs out of them. But he says, do not be fooled by these things. People will come saying, I am the Christ, and there'll be wars and rumors of wars, and nations shall rise against nation. There'll be famines and earthquakes and persecutions, and some Christians will fall away, and the gospel will be preached in the whole world. Colossians 1:23, Paul says the gospel has been preached in the whole world. That is, it's gone into all the different countries of the known world of that time. Then shall the end come. Now, are these the signs of the end? Is that what he says? No, he doesn't say these are the signs of the end. The first reason is this: the subject here is not the end of the world. What's the subject here? the fall of Jerusalem. He's not even on the... He comes to the end of the world later in the chapter, but here he is not even talking about it. Remember verse 34? This generation will not pass away till all these things are accomplished. So he is talking here about the fall of Jerusalem, not about the end of the world. And secondly, he does not give these as ways you can tell when that event's going to happen. He gives this list as a list of saying, don't be fooled by these. Now let me give an illustration of that. Let's suppose that you believed I were a prophet and that I could foretell the future. And I said to you, in your lifetime, this building is going to be destroyed. In your lifetime, this building will be destroyed. First time you heard the fire trucks, what would you say? There goes the church house. If we had strong winds coming in, hurricane or something coming, what did you say? There goes the church house. And so you'd live in this constant fear that there goes the church house. And he says, I don't want you to live like that. When you hear about these things, they are not it. That's not it. Now he's going to give a sign in a minute, but that's not it. Wars and rumors of wars and earthquakes and famines are not the sign of anything in this passage. They're the things that he does not want them to use as signs. Do not be fooled by these things. So, unfortunately, those some have taken as signs what Jesus said were not signs and made it of the end of the world, and that was not even his subject here. Now, I'm a school teacher. I'm about to give you a test. Get it right now. Don't mess up. Don't make me feel like I'm a bad teacher, all right? I'm going to give you a true-false test. Jesus gave this list, wars, rumors of wars, earthquakes and famines, as signs by which they could tell when the end of the world was coming. True or false? False. Very good. Question number two. Jesus gave these as signs by which they could tell when the end of Jerusalem was coming, true or false? False. Jesus gave these as non-signs about anything, true or false? True. Not signs of anything. Don't be fooled by these. These are not signs. Now, that's the section that people study the most when they're thinking about the end of the world. But let's move now to the real sign. Here is the real sign. Verse 15. But when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet. Now there is coming a sign. That sign was first mentioned by Daniel back in chapter 9, verse 27, when Daniel was making a prophecy about Jerusalem would be rebuilt and will last for a while, and one would be destroyed again by what he called the abomination that makes desolate. Daniel talked about that, and Jesus here quotes Daniel as saying, Daniel had it right, and whenever you see happening what Daniel was prophesying about, that'll be the sign. In that prophecy, Daniel said there's one coming who would, from another nation that's going to come and destroy Jerusalem. If we look to the account by Mark and Luke, we get even more insight into what Jesus meant here by this sign. Luke 21, verse 20 says, when you see Jerusalem compassed by armies, that's the abomination that's going to make desolate, is Jerusalem coming to be surrounded by armies. So Jesus says, when you see an army coming, you surround the city. That's the sign. You hear about wars? Forget it. Rumors of wars? Forget it. Famines? Forget it. Earthquakes? Forget it. But when you see the army coming to surround the city that's going to fulfill the prophecy that Daniel gave about the fall of the city that was coming, now that's the sign. That's the sign. Well, what do we know from history? Did an army like that come? It was an army from what empire? Roman Empire, led by a general who was the son of the emperor. The emperor then was Vespasian, and the son was Titus. And so this Titus, who would be the next emperor, came and destroyed the city of Jerusalem. And how he did it was he came and surrounded the city and he starved them out. And he surrounded it for many months. And the people got weaker and weaker and weaker. They ran out of food to eat. They went through terrible kinds of problems. And when they were in this weakened condition, he just came in and took the city and tore down the temple and burned the city. So Jesus is prophesying that that's going to happen, and it's going to be the fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy. And when you see the army coming, that is the sign. That is the sign. Then you'll know to do something. Wars and rumors of wars, forget it. But when you see the army coming around the city, that is the sign. Now's the time to do something. And so that sign is coming. Now, number five, he tells them what to do when they see the sign coming. What do you do? Exactly. Get out, and get out in a hurry. Get out and get out in a hurry. He says, if you're on the housetop, you know, there are these flat roof houses, and they had stairs on the outside, and they'd go up on the housetop. If you're up on the housetop, and this army is coming around the city, go down those stairs, and don't even go inside the house to pack a bag. You get out, because you haven't got long to leave. And if you're in the field plowing, don't go back and pack a bag. You've got to leave from where you are. You've got to get out. Once you have the chance to get out, you've got to get out. So you leave in a hurry. He goes on to say that woe to those with children in those days. Did you ever have to leave in a hurry when you had children? It's a lot harder when you got kids, isn't it? So it'll be tough if you have to leave in a hurry and you got children. And he says, pray that it won't be in the winter or on a Sabbath day. In the winter, if you've got to leave in a hurry and you don't have time to go get a coat, that's not very good, is it? And travel for Jews during those times was restricted by, they had certain limits on travel, and the gates were closed of the city and other things that made it harder to leave when the time came if you had to leave on the Sabbath day. So pray that it won't be on the Sabbath day. Pray on Saturday. Pray that it won't be when you got small children. When it happens, leave, and leave in a hurry. Now, to those who would say that this is talking about the end of the world, I would ask you, have you ever prayed the end of the world wouldn't come on Saturday? What difference would that make? You ever prayed you wouldn't have small children when the end of the world came? My guess is when you had small children, you prayed the end of the world would come. Sometimes we think maybe that's the best way to handle our children is just, Lord, come on right now. So those don't fit the end of the world. They fit the end of Jerusalem. They fit the end of Jerusalem. They fit the situation there very well. They don't have anything to do with the end of the world. We're not in end of the world territory here yet at all. Not at all. And so he says that this then is good advice for the fall of Jerusalem, but it's not good advice about the end of the world. Now here's number six. Jesus then begins to describe the nature of the event. What is this event, this coming destruction of Jerusalem, going to be like? What is it like? What's the characteristic of it? What's it about? How would we describe those times? Well, Jesus says it's going to be really, really hard times for those who are caught in that trap of the Roman army. It'll be terrible suffering. We're in verses 21 to 28 now. It'll be terrible suffering. deceivers will come telling you that the Christ is over here hiding somewhere and he's going to get us out of all this. Don't believe any of that. If the Son of Man had really come, it would be evident. He doesn't come in secret. The eagles or vultures are going to gather where the carcass is. That is, God's timetable for the end of his special dealing with the Jewish people has now reached an end. He used them all through these years to bring the Messiah, and when the Messiah came, they turned him down. And God said, that's the end of my special relationship with you. And so the carcass, the dead Judaism, now is being eaten by the eagles, is the reference here. And so where the carcass is, the eagles will be gathered. So it's going to be hard on the people who are there. They're going to have terrible suffering when that army surrounds the city and puts them through all kinds of difficulties. The interesting thing is that Eusebius, the church historian, tells us that there were Christians who, when they saw the army coming, ran and got out and did not get caught in the trap, just like Jesus told them to do. And they went to a place called Pella. And these Christians escaped the horrors of being caught in the trap of the fall of Jerusalem because they understood this passage. Like we're talking about it tonight, they understood. When you see the army coming, get out, and get out in a hurry. And they did. So here then is Jesus' description of that event. And it's going to be a terrible, difficult time. Now here is part 7. This part has within it some expressions, some phrases that some people struggle with a little bit. Because if we didn't have a context to put them in, you might think they were referring to the end of the world. But let me put them in context here. We're still before verse 34. And verse 34 says, this generation shall not pass away till all these things are accomplished. And so that tells us, well, we're not to that break point yet. Therefore, it must be dealing still with that generation. And secondly, Jesus starts this portion by saying, immediately after those days, immediately after those days. So we need to look then to this set of expressions within that context of still in the first century, still dealing with the fall of Jerusalem. And that will help us to understand what these expressions mean. Now here are those expressions. He says the sun, moon, and stars will be darkened. Sounds like the end of the world to me. But wait. You ever hear those TV commercials that say, but wait? But wait. We're still before verse 34. And when we begin to think about it, we realize, you know, there were lots of times in the Old Testament when God used expressions like that, the sun being darkened, or the moon turning to blood, or the stars falling, or things like that, as ways of talking about the calamity of a nation falling. Not the end of the world, but the nation falling. And so, in Isaiah chapter 13, verse 10, the sun, moon, and stars will be darkened at the fall of Babylon. Doesn't mean the end of the world, it's just a way of saying it'll be a very memorable event. Figuratively spoken of as the sun being darkened, okay? Not truly the sun being darkened, but in a figure of speech, the sun being darkened. Or in Ezekiel 32:7, the stars and the sun and the moon will be darkened at the fall of the Pharaoh of Egypt. Or in Joel chapter 2, verses 30 and 31, quoted by Peter in Acts chapter 2:19, the sun will be dark and the moon turned to blood at the end of the Jewish age. So God used figures like this to talk about a great event, a momentous event, the fall of the nation of Babylon, or the fall of the nation of Israel, or the fall of Jerusalem, or the fall of the Edomites, or others are spoken of in terms like this. So here, that's what Jesus is talking about. He doesn't mean that this is end of the world. He means, like the Old Testament used these figures to talk about the fall of various nations and cities, I'm going to use them in reference to the fall here of Jerusalem. Then comes the expression that says in these verses, 29 to 31, the sign of the Son of Man in heaven shall appear. Oh, someone says, that's got to be the end of the world. The sign of the Son of Man shall appear in heaven. Well, the translation of this is best read, the sign of the Son of Man in heaven shall appear. That's the way it is in some of the older translations. The NIV translates it, the sign of the Son of Man in heaven shall the sign of the Son of Man shall appear in heaven. Where was the Son of Man, Jesus, when Jerusalem was destroyed? Where was he? In heaven. This is the most specific prophecy Jesus ever gave, and when this prophecy is fulfilled, what is that? That's a sign of the Son of Man, a sign that he was who he said he was, that he could prophesy the future. And so here is a sign of the Son of Man, the prediction coming true, and where is he when he gave that prophecy? In heaven. So the sign of the Son of Man in heaven shall appear. Well, we're going through this set of ideas. The Jewish tribes shall mourn. Well, of course, they're scattered throughout the world, but when this happens, they will mourn. The Jews will mourn the fall of their city. And then they shall see the Son of Man coming. It's the expression when the Bible talks about God or Jesus coming in the clouds. Get a bridle and ride a cloud. But it's just a way of saying that God is coming to do what he said he would do with Egypt. God came and did it. And so he is riding on a cloud. Or Matthew 26:64. Jesus told the high priest, you'll see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Very interesting expression. You'll see him sitting and coming. Can a ruler sit and come at the same time? Well, yes. We might say that President George Bush sat in the White House and went to Iraq and defeated Saddam Hussein. He sat and went. He sent the forces to do it while he was still sitting over here. So Jesus is saying to the high priest, I am going to carry out what I say I will do. And you'll see it happen as you see me sitting in the cloud, coming on the clouds, but sitting in heaven. So these expressions, when seen in the context of being before verse 34, which means that all these things will be accomplished during this generation, and with the set of expressions started by the word immediately, we know that these are things that are going to happen after the fall of Jerusalem. These things will happen after his fall, the fall of that city. And so he will send his messengers, his angels, to gather the elect. That is, when Jerusalem falls, not heavenly messengers, but earthly messengers, that's the meaning of the word angel is messenger, will be sent throughout the world to gather the elect. That is, after the Jewish fall of the Jewish temple, Christianity was mostly freed of Jewish persecution and therefore had free rein to spread more in some ways than it had when it was being persecuted by the Jews. Other persecution came later, but this removed one of the obstacles to the spread of Christianity in the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem. And so his messengers will go and preach the gospel, gather the elect. Now, Jesus then goes into a section, verses 32 to 35, in which he tells the parable of the fig tree and says, when the leaves appear on the fig tree, you know the fruit won't be far behind. And so as you see these things that I have said taking place, you'll know that I am who I claim to be. You will know that if you see the army coming just around the city, you'll know that the destruction of the city won't be far behind. So when you see the leaves on the fig tree, you'll know these other things are soon to take place. And then he says, comes to this part we've already referred to, this generation shall not pass away until all these things are accomplished. This generation shall not pass away. So everything before verse 34 is for that generation, the fall of Jerusalem, that Jesus predicted. Prophesied by Daniel back in Daniel 9, and it's going to happen, and Jesus says it will take place in the lifetime of those who are hearing him speak. And it did. Happened 40 years later. Now we come to the next section, part 8, or rather part 9, the next section, part 9, starting in verse 36. But of that day and hour. Now we start this section with the word but, which suggests a change of direction. And he begins to speak not of those days as he did before, but of that day. So it sort of changes his expression here. This day that Jesus now begins to talk about, nobody knows when that will be but the Father. He says, I don't know, the angels don't know, only the Father knows. So what's he talking about now? Now he's turned to talking about the end of the world. He's passed verse 34. He's finished his discussion about the fall of Jerusalem, the destruction of the city, of the temple, and now he turns to talking about the end of the world. But of that day, an hour. You remember in Matthew chapter 7, Jesus says, many shall say to me in that day, speaking of the end of the world. He uses that day to mean end of the world. So here he says in a similar way, but of that day, nobody knows. The angels don't know, even I don't know. The Father, the setting of that date is in the Father's hands. Now hold on to that thought for a minute. Because he says, I don't know, nobody knows but the Father. He goes on to say it'll be like it was in the days of Noah. How was it in the days of Noah? Jesus says, well, people will marry and give in marriage like they did in the days of Noah. What does that mean? Well, did they know when the flood was going to come? No. So how did they act? Well, they continued with life as normal. They ate and drank and married and gave in marriage. Life went on as normal until suddenly God said, Noah, get in the ark, and the rain came. Normal days preceded it. Normal days preceded it. So Jesus says normal days are going to precede the end of the world. Be normal days. Won't be signs and special events and all these things happen. It'll be normal days. Life goes on as usual until suddenly, bang, here it is. Be like it was in the days of Noah. Then he goes on to say, it's not on the screen, but he says there'll be two in the field sowing. One is taken, one is left. There'll be two grinding at the mill. One is taken, one is left. What does that mean? Well, he's talking now about the suddenness of this event. The end of the world happens, and the judgment happens, and people are separated. There's a suddenness about it in the separation of the wicked and the righteous. So there may be two people that are side by side, whatever they're doing, and one of them is approved by God and goes with the good folks, and one is not approved and goes with the bad folks. He's talking about the immediacy of the separation of the righteous and the wicked. Now, we come on then and want to summarize these things that Jesus has said now about the end of the world. And what I want you to notice is the contrast between what he says about the end of the world and what he says about the fall of Jerusalem. A contrast. Now look at this contrast. He says of the destruction of Jerusalem, Jesus knew when that would be, didn't he? He told him it'll be in your lifetime. Jesus knew when that destruction would be. But of the end of the world, Jesus doesn't know when that's going to be. See the contrast? Jesus knows, one, that the fall of Jerusalem, does not know the end of the world. Jesus says that the destruction of Jerusalem will be abnormal before. There'll be an army coming and all these things, and people will suffer. Abnormal days precede the fall. But the end of the world, it'll be normal days, like it was in the days of Noah. Of the fall of Jerusalem, there will be a sign to warn. You'll see the army coming. Of the end of the world, there'll be no signs to warn. See the contrast? And finally, of the destruction of Jerusalem, you can run from that. Get out of the city. Of the end, you can't run from it. Immediately, one is taken, one is left. No running. Can you run from the end of the world? Where would you run? So he sets these two in contrast with each other. Now, having introduced the subject of the coming of the end of the world and given some insight into it, Jesus now enters the last part, number 10 of our study, which lasts from the end to the end of chapter 24 and all the way through chapter 25. It's all centered on one theme. Watch ye therefore. Watch ye therefore, for you know not the day nor the hour. When it comes to our thinking about the end of the world, what's the main thing we ought to do? Guess when it's going to be. Is that the main thing we ought to do? Try to predict when it's going to be. Is that it? Not going to work. The main thing is what? Watch ye therefore. And Jesus makes that point in several ways. He says, since you don't know when the Lord is coming, you must always be ready. Since the master of the house doesn't know when the thief may come, he must always be ready. He's using several ways to make the point of be ready. He goes on in chapter 5, since the virgins don't know when the bridegroom comes, what must they do? Always be ready. When the Lord comes, he will ask his servants for an accounting. Chapter 25, verses 14 through 30, the parable of the talents. So stay ready. Watch, therefore. And then finally, in chapter 25, starting in verse 31, he gives that picture of the judgment day as all are gathered, and he separates them as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And of those on his right hand, he says, come, you blessed of my Father, enter the things prepared for you from the foundation of the world. And to the wicked, he says, depart from me, I know you not. I was hungry and you didn't feed me, and I was thirsty and you didn't give me to drink. I was naked and you didn't clothe me. I was in prison and you didn't visit me. And so he shows now the final judgment of the separation and ends that section in verse 46, the wicked will go away from this judgment into eternal punishment, and the righteous will go away from this judgment into eternal life. So we've taken a review of 2.5 chapters, the last part of chapter 23, all of 24, and all of 25, all right? Because all of that ties together. And what do we learn from that? Well, we learn that Jesus was sorry that such bad things were about to happen to the Jewish people. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, it kills the prophets and stones those sent unto you. How often would I have gathered you as a hen gathers her chicks, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. Oh, Lord, look at all these wonderful buildings. Yeah, I know. That's what I'm talking about. Not one stone shall be left upon another, won't be thrown down. Well, Lord, when that's going to be, and what will be the signs by which we'll know it's going to happen? Well, let me tell you one thing. Don't be fooled by wars and rumors, wars and earthquakes and famines. Don't jump on those and think that'll tell you anything about it. But when you see the armies coming around the city, as prophesied by Daniel, you got to get out. And get out as quickly as you can. Because the times are going to be terrible for those caught in that trap. But it will come to an end. The city will be destroyed. And this generation will see it happen. But of that day and hour, I don't know when that's going to be, the end of the world. I don't know when that's coming. Only the Father knows that. But I want to tell you one thing about that. You better stay ready. Watch, therefore, for you know not the day nor the hour. And that brings us to our invitation song tonight, doesn't it? See, are you ready? Are you ready for that day to come? Well, we need to live in a state of constant readiness. We need to live so that if our time to pass from this earth comes, today we missed the funeral of the mother of our local preacher. Had we been in Oklahoma City, we would have gone to her funeral today. She lived a wonderful Christian life. She had a stroke a while back and had gone through some really tough days. And they were relieved that she passed on because she was suffering terribly. And what a great thing that Christian people can see death in that way, that it's a step forward. Is something that we can anticipate. It's something that we don't ask to happen. We don't hasten it. But when it happens, we as Christian people can say that something good lies ahead. We believe that. So if we're watching, we're ready. Then if we pass on or if Jesus comes, whichever comes first, we can look forward to that with joy and anticipation. And tonight, if you just have to say in your own heart, I really can't say I'm ready. I don't believe if he came right now that I would feel like I'd be on the goat side, not on the sheep side. Boy, this is the time that you need to do something to make a change in that. And you may need to be baptized into Christ, or you may need to come and share with us something that you want to change about your life. But don't leave this building tonight not ready for the Lord to come. That would be a terrible mistake. So if you need to do something we can help you with, will you do it while we stand and sing? I hope that you will still be thinking about inviting people to come to our remaining sessions tomorrow night to study the rapture, and Antichrist is a topic that a lot of people have an interest in. And so I hope you will, I know you've been talking to people and inviting, and do some more of that. Try to get some people to come with you tomorrow night as we study that tomorrow night. Then, of course, on Sunday, we know some of you will be back in your other congregations, but for those who are here, I hope you will want to bring people with you on Sunday if you can. On Saturday, we're having a seminar on evangelism. And we're talking about what every member of the church can do to help with evangelism. Whatever your situation is, however much you know or don't know, or whatever your circumstances are, there's a way for you to participate in the evangelism of the local church. I think it's really important for as many of you as possible to be here for that, not just the preachers and elders, but everybody to be here for that seminar. You get ideas about what you could do to help spread the gospel message. And so I hope you'll be here for that Saturday session as well.
Dr. North?
Yes.
Tomorrow evening, when we're still studying Revelation and the tribulation the 7 years of tribulation. Will you touch on the matter of the Christians who are left and have to choose between taking the mark of the beast or not, and being unable to buy or sell if they do not have the mark?
No, so let me talk about that tonight. Okay? Questions about the what's said in Revelation chapter 13, the last few verses, talks about the mark of the beast and the number 666, and people can't buy and sell and things like that. Let me just give a little setting for that passage. I believe the main thrust of the book of Revelation is about Christians soon to be under persecution by the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire is represented, Satan is represented as a dragon in Revelation. Revelation chapter 20 verse 2 and chapter 12 verse 9 clearly identify the dragon in Revelation as Satan. Then a beast is presented, and if we had time tonight to go through all the characteristics of that beast, we would see that that beast, I believe, represents the Roman Empire. In chapter 13, verses 5 through 7, it talks about this beast as being one that rules over tribes and tongues and peoples and nations, and that persecuted Christians, and that it accepted the worship of the people. And in chapter 17, verse 10, it associates it with seven hills, and we know that Rome had seven hills. And so all of these characteristics point toward the Roman Empire as being the first beast. The second beast, that's also mentioned in chapter 13, was described as the beast that went around and set up the heads or statues of the first beast and made people worship them, and that would be emperor worship. And there was a lot of that the Roman Empire required people to worship, and Christians were asked to come and take a pinch of incense and put it on the altar to the emperor and say, "Caesar is God." And if they refused, they were taken out and killed. And that's what was coming soon upon the church. And so the book of Revelation is written to help these Christians understand what's happening, and that God has not forgotten them, that he still remembers them, and he is finding ways to use this persecution for something good. The church, it spread the church, didn't it? The church got stronger during the persecution, not weaker. And so God was using it for a good purpose, even though Satan was trying to stamp out the church. But it's tough for the Christians living through that. They don't understand. Why, Lord, why are you letting this happen? And so the book of Revelation is written to give them some insight into what is coming. Now, in the storyline of the book of Revelation, there are good guys and bad guys. When you watch a Western, how do you know the good guys from the bad guys? The good guys wear the white hats, the bad guys wear the black hats. In the book of Revelation, the good guys have the mark of Jehovah on their foreheads, and the bad guys have the mark of the beast. It's just a way of saying in the story, let me tell you who the good guys are and the bad guys are. The bad guys follow the beast. And it's as if he had put their mark on them, not a literal 666 on their foreheads, but they're the bad guys. They're the black hat guys, and those that follow Christ are the good guys. And they have the mark of God on their foreheads, the name of Jehovah written on their foreheads, it says later. And so so it's a way in the storyline of saying, I want you to know there are those who follow Jesus, they're the good guys, and those who follow the beast, the Romans, they're the bad guys. Now, the buying and selling, you see, if you were an outcast, if you were a Christian, you were discriminated against in the marketplace. You couldn't buy and sell. There were things you couldn't do economically because of who you were. You might not be hired, you might lose your job, you might have things against you because you're a Christian. And Christians not only suffered in the sense that they had persecution of physical harm, but they also had economic harm because they were Christians. Have you ever known a Christian to lose his job today because he was a Christian, stood for certain things? Yeah, I have. I had a man come to me and said, I'm going to lose my job if I don't cheat in keeping the books of this company. And he said, what shall I do? And I said, what do you think? He said, well, I can't do that. Okay. So he's going to lose his job because he's a Christian. So, and it was much worse in those days, of course. So that's the idea there, is that Satan is going to be trying to use the Roman Empire to stamp out the church. He's going to do it by starting emperor worship that will put the church in conflict with the Romans and be the reason why the Romans persecute. And then he's encouraging them to be faithful. Now we'll get more into that Sunday morning in our Bible class when we talk about Armageddon. You may find this hard to believe, but Sunday morning in the lesson on Armageddon, we will summarize the entire book of Revelation in 30 minutes. Wow. Well, we're going to try anyway. But so I just did it in 3 minutes. We're going to do it in 30 minutes on Sunday morning. But anyway, I think that's what the buying and selling has got to do. And the mark of the beast, we don't know for sure about the mark of the beast. You see, here's a very interesting thing about that we have to understand when we study the Bible. The Bible, the New Testament books were written to specific people dealing with specific circumstances. And sometimes we don't understand all of what they understood when they received the book. Paul sometimes says, when I was with you, I told you about this. Now let me tell you some more about it. Well, we don't know what he told them when he was with them, you know. So we have to understand, we want to try to get in their mindset as much as we can and understand what they understood from it, and then we apply that to ourselves. So I think 666 was something that was a clue for them that's not a clue for us. Something in their society that they understood about 666 that made it possible for them to understand more easily what the book was talking about. But we don't know what that was, because it's not a part of our culture. It was part of their culture, not part of ours. So we can only guess at it, and some think it had to do with maybe something about somebody's name. You know, each letter in the Roman alphabet had a numerical equivalent, you know, like X means 10 and V means 5 and whatever. So they would sometimes take somebody's name and add up all the numbers and see what their number was. So some think this is a reference to Nero, maybe one of the Roman emperors, where if you add up the letters of his name, that it comes out 666 and some things like that. So we don't really know for sure. It was a clue for them because they knew something about that we don't know. So it's hard for us to know exactly what that was about. But it's not a big computer in Belgium, and it's not the barcodes at the grocery store, and it's not some of the things people talk about today that it might be. But it was a clue to them, but it's not really a clue to us.